Hello and welcome to the Irish History Show on Near FM. My name is Cathal Brennan, and as always I'm joined by my co-presenter John Dorney from theirishstory.com. If you would like to listen to this or previous episodes of the show, go to the Near FM podcast page at nearfm.ie/podcast. You might like to check out two new shows from Near FM, Reinterpreting 1913, which looks at the influence that the 1913 lockout had on a number of artistic disciplines, and To the Ends of the Earth, a documentary series on the Irish military diaspora in South America. On today's show, we're very pleased to be joined by Pádraig Yates and Dr. John Borgonovo. Pádraig Yates is a distinguished social and labour historian and the author of Lockout, Dublin 1913, the standard work on the great 1913 labour dispute. He is also author of the acclaimed A City in Wartime and A City in Turmoil. The third book in the series, A City in Revolution, is due in 2014. Dr. John Borgonovo is an American-born but Cork-based historian. He has written Spies, Informers and the Anti-Sinn Féin Society, The Intelligence War in Cork City, 1920-21, on the War of Independence in Cork City. More recently, he has written The Battle for Cork City, 1922, and The Dynamics of War and Revolution, Cork City, 1916-1918. He teaches at University College Cork.
Hello, John and Pádraig. W.B. Yeats, the famous Irish poet, famously wrote of 1916, "Always changed utterly." Should he have really used 1914 and the outbreak of the Great War? And I ask you two gentlemen, as people who've written books about specifically Irish cities during wartime, in the case of Pádraig, Dublin City, and in the case of John, your beloved Cork. I'll start with you, Pádraig. Is 1914 the most important date in Irish 20th century history?
It's probably the most important date in world history because everything else tends to flow from that. But certainly in Ireland, Britain, across Europe, it transformed the situation and it made possible things like the Irish Revolution, which would not have taken the form they did otherwise.
Yeah, I agree. And it, you know, changed the trajectory. The Home Rule crisis was going down a certain trajectory, and then all of a sudden we went a different direction. And then we were involved in all kinds of events globally and locally and European-wide that were, again, as Pádraig said, changed just the dynamics of the whole situation on the ground here.
Now, here in Ireland, there was a very specific context to the outbreak of war because it was preceded directly by the Home Rule crisis in Dublin by shootings at Bachelor's Walk, where the British Army shot at people who were jeering them after the volunteers had illegally imported arms. So question to both of you. I'll start with you, John, just to reverse order. How was the outbreak of the Great War in August 1914 actually greeted on the ground?
Well, one of the kind of misperceptions is that they were somehow celebrating. People were celebrating the outbreak of the war. That wasn't necessarily true, but there was a embrace of the war as a political opportunity, also as part of kind of a great national endeavor and challenge, but national in this case being United Kingdom and Empire. So there was nervousness, there was trepidation, but there was also support for, especially for those troops who were being called up. Thousands of reserves were being activated in the cities, people who had served previously in the British Army that were recalled to the colors. They were all of a sudden back in uniform, being marched to train stations, being cheered by their families, crowds of well-wishers who only wished the best for them. So in those first days, it was just seemed like the whole world had been kind of tossed up in the air, and then slowly kind of the realities of the new situation started to become more apparent.
Well, Dublin was a bit unusual in that, as you referred to, John, they had the host gun running, and then there were three people shot dead in the aftermath of that by British soldiers and 80 people wounded. So that cast a pall over the whole thing. And if you look at the corporation minutes for the following meeting, it was totally dominated by the shootings. The war might never have happened. You wouldn't know from the local debates what was going on in the rest of Europe. So it was a very unusual start to the war. But as John Borgonovo said, thousands of reservists were called up. We think that nearly 3,000 members of the Transport Union alone were called up and would have been back with their regiments within 48 hours of the declaration of war.
And certainly there were accounts of cheering crowds in the early days of the war.
And in Dublin, in the Fusiliers, the volunteer element, if you like, in the Fusiliers, the people who joined up in answer to Redmond's call in 1915 had this spectacular send-off. They were only going to the training camps in England, but they got this spectacular send-off. And then in 1915, a lot of them were slaughtered at Gallipoli. Gallipoli was Dublin's Somme, and once the telegram started arriving, you know, on people's doorsteps in 1915, saying their father or their brother or son or whatever had been killed, that any enthusiasm for the war died pretty rapidly after that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd agree with that too, Padraig. It also Gallipoli affected Cork City quite a bit because the Munster Fusiliers were also in with the Dubs, and they took really heavy casualties. And so that's also one thing to think about in terms of the Irish take case is the Irish division in Gallipoli took massive casualties much earlier than a lot of the British units did elsewhere on the Somme. So, you know, the real heavy Gallipoli casualties were mid-1915, a year before the Somme, and that's when you start seeing thousands of, you know, a couple thousand Irishmen were killed in a very short period of time. And as I said, the reality of this new industrial warfare started becoming apparent all across the country.
Well, I might ask both of you, why was the 10th Irish Division almost ignored afterwards in a way that the 16th and the 36th Divisions weren't?
Well, you could say they were ignored during the war. And one thing that caused a lot of disillusionment was when the British were trying to explain away the disaster at Gallipoli, one of the excuses Hamilton used, the British commander, was that the Irish didn't get on quickly enough. The Anzac forces were achieving all their objectives, and if the Irish had just, you know, done their bit, and that was leaked to the press. So not only were people getting reports of their loved ones dying or being seriously injured, they're also being told they just weren't up to the job.
The division also didn't fight as a division. It was kind of parceled out, and that was also a cause of a lot of unrest and a lot of unhappiness, that they weren't really allowed to fight as a single unit. And as Padraig said, too, that the combat performance, there were some questions about that. In Hamilton's kind of big brief about the whole campaign, he didn't mention the Irish troops, and that caused a tremendous amount of resentment because they'd taken such heavy casualties. So while we always associate Australia and the Anzacs with Gallipoli, we don't necessarily associate the Irish troops, although we should, because they took, you know, percentage-wise, they took as many casualties as the Anzacs did. And then when you look at local meeting minutes as well, in Cork, you also see expressions of hostility and anger about the British government not recognizing the sacrifice played by Irish troops in Gallipoli, and that's kind of the caused a resentment that seemed to have endured for a while.
Backing up a little bit, I mean, we talked about reservists were called up to the colours, and quite a few Irishmen were actually serving in 1914 in the regular British Army, but several tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands even of volunteers did join up for the wartime. Do we know why people joined up? Was it for home rule? Was it to save Belgium? Even to fight for the Empire in some cases? Or was it simply for economic benefits, for the separation allowance? Where do you guys come down on that question?
The allowance was certainly a big thing, particularly if you're in a job like, say, Dublin Corporation or Guinness, where you were given half pay. If you joined the British Army and you were a labourer, and say you're on 20 shillings a week and you got half pay, that's 10 shillings. You get 7 shillings a day as a soldier, that's another 7 shillings a week. Your wife gets 12 and 6, and she gets another 2 and 6 for every child. And it's however many children you have. Whereas if you were in a job, it didn't matter how hard you worked. If you had 5 or 6 kids, you weren't going to get any extra money for it. So there was a very powerful economic incentive. Later on in the war as well, though, there was a very powerful economic one for people who couldn't find work, particularly in the drinks industry. The drinks industry in Dublin, I imagine in Cork and elsewhere, was almost taxed out of existence. So employers were pushing people towards the front. And the final thing was that it dawned on people, if you were volunteering, you could volunteer to a particular unit. You didn't have to join the infantry. So a lot of Irish volunteers from 1916, 17 onwards were joining things like REMI, the Electrical and Mechanical Corps, or the Royal Flying Corps, where they were training as maintenance crews. So they were learning a skill, they were getting reasonably well paid, their families were being looked after, and they weren't in any danger.
Yeah, I think that the economic issue is a real important one. I mean, one of the reasons they were operating separation allowances was to encourage people to enlist. But there, you know, you think about it, there are all kinds of different reasons. Some people were joining up for home rule. I think that's been a little bit overstated. I don't necessarily think all the nationalists who were joining up were doing so because John Redmond said to do so. I think it was some peer pressure, some excitement, a lot of encouragement from other folks, a lot of people being mobilized by propaganda, being mobilized by government policy. I think it's a whole bunch of different factors, but you can't get away from it when you look at the recruiting numbers. The real huge numbers came out of the cities, and they came out of the urban poor of the cities, and so there's a consistent kind of level of poverty in a lot of the Irish recruits. Not all of them, but it's a kind of a consistent theme. and really the Ireland's contribution to the uniform military was coming from urban Ireland.
Yeah, would I be right in saying, in fact, that places like Dublin and Cork and Belfast played a disproportionate role in recruitment?
I think Dublin and Belfast alone accounted for over half of all recruits. But again, it's that tradition. And in Dublin, it was quite normal to be in the British Army. I mean, my father, my grandfather in the British Army, for example, there was nothing wrong about being in the British Army. Where I think in rural Ireland, not so much in the cities like Cork, but in the countryside, there was a social stigma to being in the British Army. You're a total failure if you joined the British Army. You know, if you robbed the poor box or got some local girl in trouble, you joined the British Army. But it was not a wise career move. It wouldn't be seen as a very laudable thing to do anyway.
You also see what's interesting is there's also traditions of service in the Royal Navy in a lot of the coastal communities. And so you see those traditions kind of being revived as well. So yeah, there's a lot of the urban areas, as Padraig said, you see these family connections and you know, people rejoining, fathers and sons going in together, you know, or people who were coming from, you know, major families where a number of their brothers, three or four or five, might be in the family, their uncles. That's very much an urban phenomenon. Also in some of the garrison towns as well, you see really big numbers coming from places like up in Tip, you know, and kind of traditional, you know, Fermoy, Tralee, kind of traditional garrison capitals. And the same thing where you have communities of ex-soldiers. They really send a lot of people out as well.
What effect did reports of German atrocities in Belgium have on public opinion in Ireland, Bork?
Well, that's a good question. We did have Belgian refugees come here, but they're a bit like the Belfast refugees from the pogroms later on. People like to talk about them, but when they arrive on your doorstep, you're not so keen on them. But they were resettled in various parts of Ireland. And there's this famous story about the Germans chopping off the left hand of people who were caught with weapons or who were suspect, which has never been proven anywhere. The interesting thing, though, of course, is that in King Leopold of Belgium, you know, in the Belgian Congo, that was a punishment, apparently, for stealing rubber or whatever from your masters. So that seems to be the source of that story. I don't think it had a huge impact in Dublin, although having said that, of course, there's a famous article by Tom Kettle about the German attack on Louvain and sacking of Louvain, which obviously moved him very much and must have had an effect on his generation and on his milieu that he lived amongst. And they saw Germany as the modern threat of barbarism to civilized society. So I think it did have an effect, but I don't think it ever had any real effect. There's a famous one about Mick O'Leary in Cork where his father was addressing an election meeting and he said his incitement to people to join the British Army was, if you don't, when the Germans come here, they'll treat you just as badly as the Brits do, you know, but as the British do. So, you know, there was that sort of weird sort of, I think, ambivalence towards, as it was in the Second World War, that weird ambivalence to the Germans that they were giving the Brits a good kicking, so they couldn't be all bad.
And John, what effect did that have in Cork? Was there any specific mention of the Belgian atrocities in the Cork newspapers?
Oh, absolutely. Well, when you read about recruiting meetings, the real heavy recruiting campaign took place kind of in early kind of the first half of 1915, and when you read the count of those meetings, they're constantly referring to Belgium. They're also very much referring to allegations of atrocities against Catholic clergy, especially nuns, sacking of churches, sexual crimes against nuns. That's one that struck me. A whole bunch of different recruiters mentioned the same thing. And this kind of idea that it's a religious war, and it's very apparent that one of the ideas of appealing to the Irish Catholics is by emphasizing this Catholic dimension to the war, and that's what Belgium really plays its part. You know, how much that really affected folks enlisting, I don't know. I don't know how successful it was. But as Padraig said, there was also one of the classes that was very much mobilized in this country was the Catholic middle class, people who went to the universities, people who were kind of fairly wealthy, part of the Catholic establishment. They joined the British Army in very big numbers, you know, becoming officers predominantly, but not necessarily or exclusively. And in terms of that Catholicism, that Catholic nationalism, you would think that message might have appealed more directly to them than to other folks.
One thing that's never mentioned, really, but strikes me as significant in terms of Irish Catholic, I should say, attitudes towards the war, is that the Pope actually, I think, condemned the war in 1915, having been ambivalent about it earlier on. Did that have any effect on Irish attitudes?
Yeah, you start seeing the hierarchy become much more vocal against the war. And the idea of kind of a plague on both your houses start becoming expressed. And, really in 1916 and 17, that becomes more and more apparent that, that more and more members of the hierarchy aren't that happy with the war. And then that feeds into the really widespread mobilization of the Catholic Church against conscription. And there's intense Catholic opposition to conscription before 1918, going back to 1917, even going back to 1916, or early 1916. So it does seem like the church's position on the war does change, and that starts to mitigate some of Catholic perceptions about it.
Yeah, no, I agree. John has summed it up very well. In Dublin, you had the extra anomaly, of course, that Willie Walsh, the Archbishop of Dublin, was probably the most nationalist of the bishops of the hierarchy. So he was never keen on the war. But certainly he began to manoeuvre himself into a position of detachment from Redmond and from the war effort quite early on. And he was well positioned then, after 1916, to throw his weight effectively behind Sinn Féin. But he was preparing his audience for a change. And I'm not saying that he was a Shinner in 1914 or 15, but as John says, the fact that the church was coming out against Germany in particular, it gave leeway for people like him to start making noises and to criticise a movement they're very unhappy with. They were very unhappy with Redmond selling out on partition and abandoning, if you like, nationalists in the north. They were very angry about that, as was people like William Martin Murphy. As well. On the other hand, then you had people like Connolly, who were effectively pro-German in the Irish Worker and Workers' Republic after the war broke out, for completely different reasons. So there was this space developing below or beside the Redmondite position of unconditional support for the war, of other people saying, no, we're not that mad about the war, actually, and we think maybe it was a mistake. And if there'd been a quick victory, Redmond would have probably been on the pig's back, and it could be seen as a masterstroke. But because the longer the war lasted, the more privation kicked in, the more hardship people felt, the more they were going to blame Redmond as well as the British for the coal shortages, the food shortages, and profiteering and all the rest of it.
You know, one thing I'd pop in there in agreement is, also think about Redmond's. Redmond was the most pro-war of his party. I mean, he was kind of at the furthest, if you're putting it on a right-left perspective, he'd be the most pro-war, kind of furthest right of his party. A lot of people in his party weren't as happy or weren't as willing to engage in recruiting. The idea of standing on a recruiting platform was a big step for members of the Irish Parliamentary Party. A lot of members didn't do it, or wanted to do everything short of appearing on a recruiting platform. So Redmond's embrace, kind of full embrace of the war, wasn't necessarily shared by other members of his party, other members of the leadership of his party, and it didn't really sit that well. And then that kind of set the stage for when the war started going badly, people became much more rapidly disaffected.
Pork mentioned there James Connolly, who obviously is a very famous leader of Irish separatism, Irish socialism, republicanism. But one of the most bitter foes I see in both of your books that the separatists or the republicans faced on the streets of Dublin and Cork were the separation women. Can you say something about these people and why they were so bitterly hostile, certainly in the first few years of the war, to Irish nationalists or radical Irish nationalists?
Well, they were of a different social class. They were from the labouring class, the kind of the real core working class. They were expressing solidarity with their loved ones who were in uniform. That to me seemed to be their primary allegiance was to their loved ones, people who were out there fighting and dying in big numbers. And so the idea that you'd have people, you know, the Republicans, the Shinners, as they were called, marching and a few expressing pro-German sentiments, but a lot just most expressing anti-war sentiments. That didn't sit well at all. And so, kind of in that loyalty to their members of their family and to members of their class, they rose up and they were extremely vocal. They were extremely physical. They were willing to engage. There were a number of attacks on the Irish volunteers prior to 1916, even going into 1917. The Waterford by-election was extremely violent, and a lot of that violence was coming from separation women in Waterford. And so where you see the separation women phenomena is in urban Ireland, where you have this really dense areas with heavy enlistments into the British Army. That's where it pops up, not just in Cork, not just in Dublin, but also in Limerick, Waterford, up in Offaly, Longford, all those places.
Yeah, the separation women, I should say, so-called, because they received the separation allowance. Pork, do you have anything to say about that?
Yeah, well, I'd agree with John, absolutely. Also, we've got to remember that, unfortunately, the Easter Rising came at the anniversary of a big battle on the Western Front, where most of the old contemptibles in the Dublin Fusiliers,
the regular soldiers, yeah,
who had gone back, were wiped out. So the anniversary of that was actually at exactly the same, it was the end of April, exactly the same time as the Easter Rising. So for a lot of those families, that was a very raw memory. And then they were being stabbed in the back as they saw it by the volunteers. And also the other thing we have to remember is that those women were overwhelmingly, as John has said, working class. The majority of the volunteers were middle class or upwardly mobile working class, particularly skilled workers. So they would have been a cut above the people in the army. And the other group we mustn't forget are the women who worked in Dublin. Dublin was very good for working class women, the war was, because of the munitions industry and the textile industry. Women had jobs that they couldn't have hoped to have had before. They were going out earning their own living. Some of them were spending it and spending it quite ostentatiously. And there was a resentment, that these people were getting above themselves. They were wearing clothes they shouldn't have been wearing. They were drinking in pubs. They were going out and enjoying themselves. They were going to music halls. They were philandering with soldiers. They were just making disgrace of the city in O'Connell Street and the thoroughfares of the city. And there were even patrols supported by the DMP who would go out to monitor the behaviour of these women and tell them to go home if they got too out of hand. So there was a huge class resentment there as well. These women, their husbands were in the army in some cases, but a lot of them were just young girls who suddenly were earning a lot of money and were spending it and didn't mind who knew they were spending it.
John, what effect did the war have on Irish agriculture and Irish exports?
I think one of the kind of misperceptions is how great the war was for Ireland. The war was very good for big farmers. You had the price for produce, the price for meat, the price for vegetables, all that stuff, all grain, everything went through the roof. So it was great times to be a big farmer. Prices went absolutely through the roof, skyrocketed. There was also, though, a kind of a knock-on effect where you stopped having compulsory land purchases. So there was a kind of an adding up of congested districts. After the Windham Act, Irish land was being distributed, and they were kind of the emergence of this new small farmer class. Those purchases stopped during the war, and so by 17 and 1918, you start seeing kind of land hunger breaking out and kind of an outbreak of a kind of strong agrarianism in early 1918. It was a good time to be a farm laborer because farm laborers have traditionally been very hard. It's very difficult to organize farm laborers because there was such a plethora of unemployment. Unemployment was so high that it was very hard to organize unskilled labor. Because the war created a manpower shortage, all of a sudden you had fewer unemployed people, so farm laborers could organize themselves. You also had more land under acreage. So they started having compulsory tillage orders that basically created about 10, 15, 20% more land under tillage, meaning that a lot more people were working. There was a lot more demand for labor. So you start seeing radical organization of farm laborers by the ITGWU in 1917 and really in 1918. And that's when things start getting a little bit unsettled.
Pork, was the war good or bad for the urban poor?
Well, in Dublin it was good. I mean, if you take the fundamental indices, I always use is the death rate, which is a very blunt instrument. But, if people aren't dying in the same numbers as usual, even in 1916 when there was fighting on the streets, the death rate was falling. Mm. So overall, people were living longer. Fewer children were dying. There were fewer complaints about child cruelty or malnutrition because mothers were earning money or either through their husbands at the front or in factories. So they were being able to feed their families properly, as well as this image of them being out drinking all the time. The fact is that children were better off, better nourished. The British government introduced a number of initiatives, public education on how to feed and look after children and so on. But as John has said already, on the land, it was quite a big plus for agricultural labourers because the British government introduced regulations covering all the sort of sensitive war industries. They didn't want industrial strife at home while they're fighting in Germany. So it wasn't just shipyards or railways, it was agriculture. And they set out rates of pay and hours of work for agricultural labourers. And agricultural labourers found that the best way to get these was to join a union. They joined the transport union in large groups. And the union would go and sort out the farmers for them because they had the backing of the Board of Trade. So you had this unusual situation of unions going in to negotiate better paying conditions with the farmers, and the state was actually supporting them because they wanted food for the war effort. So it was, for the urban poor and maybe for some of the rural poor, it wasn't bad news.
Going back to the rural thing as well, you also start seeing a kind of a long-standing tension, the cow versus plow, tillage versus people who are raising livestock. And that becomes a major issue as food shortages start becoming a concern. And when food rationing is brought into Britain in 1918, all of a sudden the Irish market becomes a lot more competitive, and there's a lot of concern about possible shortages, and you start seeing kind of a real fear. And so that's when you start seeing resentment taken out against people who are raising livestock rather than tillage farming. And in the outbreak in 1918, you see massive kind of big mobs going out and knocking down fences and plowing pasture land. And that's part of this kind of food crisis that came out in kind of early 1918.
Now we're just going to take a very quick break, and we'll be back with John and Porrick after the break. And we're back. We're here with John Borgonovo and Porrick Yates talking about the First World War and how it affected Dublin and Cork. Now, John, if I could ask you first, when we hear mention of the 16th and the 36th, what were they and how were they treated differently by the British Army?
The high-level organizational unit was a division, and that was between about 10,000 and 15,000 soldiers. And these were deployed. And Ireland supplied three divisions of troops to the British forces. Now, keep in mind that the British Army ended up having about, I don't know, somewhere like 80, 90 divisions, somewhere along those lines. So it wasn't that big of a number. But in Ireland, these three divisions took on very much a national identity. Two of them, the 10th and the 16th, were predominantly Catholic, and they were presumed to be kind of Irish nationalist. The third was the 36th Division, which was raised in Ulster and was really championed by the Ulster Unionists and took on kind of an orange identity. The 36th especially became very important, became part of the foundation myth of Northern Ireland, in that these orange folks died in massive numbers in the Battle of the Somme, sacrificing themselves for Northern Ireland in defense of loyal Ulstermen against the possible forced immersion into a home rule Catholic Ireland. So their sacrifice in the Somme became very much an important part of the foundation myth in Northern Ireland. Keep in mind that 36 wasn't exclusively Protestant. There were some Catholics serving there who aren't really remembered. Keep in mind also the idea of it being really a second generation of the Ulster Volunteer Force doesn't really stand up to scrutiny. It wasn't necessarily entirely loyalist in terms of being members of the paramilitary Ulster Volunteer Force. It was kind of distinctly, it was raised in Northern Ireland, wasn't entirely political, but it did have this identification with Ulster Unionism. The 10th and the 16th, again, were very much associated with kind of Catholic Ireland, especially the 16th. The 16th was very much affiliated with the Irish Parliamentary Party, with John Redmond. His son served there, his brother died there, a number of Irish Party elites, relations served with it. That was very much seen as the Irish Party's division that it was associated with, and it served on the Western Front. And then this 10th Division was the first one raised. It's the one that's often kind of forgotten. It was included a lot of the old regular army units and kind of a lot of the other folks who were raised. Subsequently, it was predominantly Catholic, although a lot of its officers were Protestant, and it was served initially in Gallipoli, where it was blooded and badly damaged, and then it subsequently went to Salonika. There's a lot of kind of popular memory about that. And then it ended up the war in Gaza, in Palestine, in Syria, and by that time it had pretty much run out of its Irish folks and was being reinforced by non-Irish soldiers, especially, you know, like a third of the division was Indian by the end of the war. The kind of Irish components of all three divisions basically were diluted and pretty much almost extinguished by the end of the war owing to a lack of new recruits. So that these divisions were no longer as Irish by the end of the war as they had been in 1915.
Porrick, was it the case that the dilution of the Irish character, particularly of the 16th, and its officering in many cases by British officers was a source of discontent?
No, I think it was a source of indifference at that stage. People lost the connection with the war. as John has said, the Irish role in the war was never highlighted particularly. It was largely ignored. And the feeling became mutual. I think there was increasing alienation from the war effort. And that is manifested in the fact that, as I was saying earlier, a lot of people were joining non-combat units where they could get skills and be out of danger. So when they left, they'd be a welder or a mechanic or something, and they wouldn't be risk their lives at all. So there was that disconnect. And I think they tended also to younger people of apprenticeship type age, leaving the tenements to join. Now, there were still some older people, but there was not maybe there was in Belfast, but certainly in Dublin, there wasn't that communal thing. Having said that, 25,000 people from Dublin did join the British Army in the First World War. 5,000 were killed. The vast majority came back to Ireland. Not all of them. I heard of one Dubliner who married a French girl and was still there in 1944 when the Allies came through and liberated the town he was in from, I'm just trying to remember the name of it now, but it was near the battlefields of the First World War. So some people did stay. A lot of people stayed in England. We don't know how many for certain came back to Dublin, but 20,000, it's a lot of people, and they were a part of a community, if at times a hidden community, and they were famous. I suppose the most famous one is Kilester. There were another one in Pembroke of ex-servicemen's cottages built by the War Office, basically, as part of the Land Fit for Heroes programme, and the Irish benefited from that. And that caused resentment because you had to, in Britain, a certain proportion of those houses actually went to people who were homeless. You didn't have to be in the army. But in Ireland, and particularly in the South, you had to have been an ex-serviceman to avail of one of those houses. And the other interesting thing is, when you died, your family didn't necessarily stay there. If it was another ex-serviceman who needed a house, he got it. So there's that sort of hidden legacy from the war, largely forgotten now. But Kilester always had its own little commemoration up until after the Second World War. A lot of local families in Kilester, they had a Legion Hall building there, which was attacked in the 20s and 30s from time to time. But they had their own sense of community. But generally speaking, I think the vast majority of servicemen in Dublin disappeared after the war back into their communities. It was something like 5,000 British servicemen looking for accommodation for themselves and their families in Dublin in the immediate aftermath of the First World War.
We've spoken about a gradual disaffection in Ireland from the war effort, but of course, right in the middle of the war, there was an incredibly dramatic break, which was the Easter Rising. And thereafter, we start to see much more pronounced opposition to the war in Ireland. Is it the Rising or is it conscription, do you think, John?
I think it's an interesting one. That's kind of quite a choice.
It's a tough one.
Huh? I would say that prior to the Rising, opinion was already changing. Early 1916, there had been almost a kind of a first conscription crisis where conscription was introduced to the United Kingdom in January 1916, except Ireland. And the reason it wasn't introduced here was because of anticipated deep opposition to it. So there was a lot of fear already. I think the Rising was kind of a fulcrum for opposition. It became a catalyst. I think that the discontent was already there. I think the conscription crisis was as big as the Rising, if not bigger, because then you have this really intensive mobilization of nationalist Ireland, and that's what the Republicans really channel into the independence movement. And it's hard to see how they would have been able to get that amount of energy, that kind of levels of support, without something as major, as unifying as the conscription crisis.
Pork?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think after the Rising, obviously the Rising was very important in Dublin, but after the Rising, the Republican movement or the separatist movement was on its back, and repression did work for a while. I think it was the conscription threat that gave a second wind to that movement and got people out, and got them not just out, but they found for the first time they weren't in an isolated minority being shunned, that other people wanted to join the volunteers or wanted to join Sinn Féin, but particularly the volunteers, to show their opposition to the conscription. They didn't want to go and fight somebody else's war. So, yeah, no, I'd agree. I think the Rising was important. Before the Rising was important, certainly in Dublin, a lot of evidence of disillusionment with the war, about the way it was affecting everyday life. As I say, things like coal, hospitals are having to have great difficulty heating water, public baths were closed on occasion because of coal shortages. You've got to remember, in those days, if you wanted a bath or you wanted to wash your clothes, you did it in the public baths. You didn't do it in a tenement where you'd have to bring a bucket of water up 4 or 5 stories. It wasn't practical. So those sort of things really impinged on people and made them resent all this hardship that was being inflicted on them by the British government and by their agent, if you like, increasingly seen as their agent in Ireland, John Redmond. I think it was there even before 1916. I think Owen McNeill actually had the best summary of the situation. He believed they shouldn't rise until the British introduced conscription. They should use their weapons to defend the populace against conscription, whereas Pearse and Connolly were hell-bent on having a rise in come what may. Now, it worked out for them, or worked out for their successors, as it happened. But I think his strategy was actually a much more clearly thought one, and might have yielded bigger benefits in the long term. We'll never know. But I agree absolutely with John. Rising was important, but conscription was at least as important.
Then also in the urban areas, you're also seeing really heavy inflation. So prices kind of double, and that starts affecting people who are on fixed incomes. It's also kind of uncertainty. There's this kind of increased anxiety that you start seeing in late 1917, early 1918. Also, it seems like the British might be losing the war. I mean, keep in mind that that's becoming increasingly an increasing possibility, especially when the Russians pull out. So wartime morale seems to kind of plummet. There's an increased burden on people. There's also just increased anxiety about what's going to happen, whether there might be another famine, whether there's going to be, economic disaster, whether this war is going to go on forever, whether there's going to be a civil war. All this stuff is just kind of churning up and just causing a kind of discontent that's very hard to quantify, except that it does seem to be there. When you read kind of the reports and the police reports, they all mention it. They refer to it as kind of, sedition. But it's atmosphere of sedition, but it's also just general discontent and anxiety.
Well, Porrick, what reception do British Army recruiters and recruiting meetings receive as the war goes on?
Well, it certainly changes. Certainly in Dublin by 1918, Lynch, the famous commander of one of the two Irish brigades in the South African War, is brought in and given the rank of colonel to recruit in Dublin, and he was booed off platforms. On one occasion he had to seek refuge, in private buildings, even with the protection of the DMP. Sinn Féin would basically take over the platforms and address the crowds. Extreme hostility by 1917-1918, and John would be much better placed to answer that in other parts of the country, but inflation and economic pressures generally were all part of that. And in fact, if you want to be cynical about it, you could say the reason the Americans came into the war was to save their investment in the Allied war effort, because all their bondholders would have been burnt if Germany had defeated France and Britain. I mean, a lot of French bondholders were burnt by the collapse of Russia. So there are other things.
Burn the bondholders.
That's right. Bring back the Kaiser.
You see the same thing with the conscription meetings being attacked. Basically, the country was given recruiting quotas in all these different districts, and you were supposed to deliver a certain number of recruits or conscription would come in, and that was kind of also aroused a lot of anger. That's kind of a very direct threat, kind of like a big, sword of Damocles hanging over a community's head. If they don't deliver so many young men, the whole setup would be conscripted. And in terms of those who did join, what's interesting, Podrick has mentioned this already, but the people who joined at this stage, there were people going in. Not nearly as many as were requested, but they were predominantly going into the RAF. As Podrick said, it's a better setup. You're getting trained. It's also you're not seeing any combat. It's the best way of ensuring that you don't go into the trenches is by joining the RAF as ground staff. 50 miles up, or 10 or 15 miles behind the lines in relative comfort and safety. And so that the only people who are joining, or most of the people who are joining up, are joining the kind of the safest option available.
Backing up just a little bit, in April 1918, the Germans launched their big offensive, and the British, belatedly, having brought in conscription in Britain 2 years before, attempt to introduce conscription. They actually passed the bill in the British House of Parliament. And as John has alluded to already, there's a massive campaign of civil disobedience in Ireland, including a one-day general strike and a pledge signed by all the political parties. In hindsight, is this the start of the nationalist revolution?
I would say so. I would say I think that's the chapter I have. That's my own second to last chapter in my book, and I think I call it revolution. I mean, that's
insurrection.
That's
I think, John.
What's that?
Insurrection. I think you call it. If I remember correctly.
Insurrection. Yeah. Very. Thank you. Thank you. Not having it in front of me. But yeah, I when you look at it, man, there's massive civil disobedience. There's massive preparation for physical force resistance. There's very sophisticated plans of civil disobedience from labor. One thing they're planning that I found interesting was they were planning a run on banks by having simultaneous withdrawals of cash from all the banks to basically create bank runs to collapse the banks, again, kind of going back to contemporary feelings. But you see women marching, you see big meetings of women workers taking pledges not to replace men who are conscripted. Even stuff like solicitors are being mobilized and being given military court-martial manuals so they can prepare for mass court-martials, and people are being instructed on how to act if they're arrested for conscription. So it's a pretty mad period in Irish history. I mean, it's very much open defiance of Dublin Castle and of law and order.
Pork, and one of my kind of pet theories about that particular time is that it was in the conscription crisis that the separatists won over the very, if you like, lumpen proletariat with whom they'd been fighting earlier in the war. What do you make of that idea?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting idea. I think there's some evidence for that. PKS most people weren't in the war, but I don't know that it's... if you look at the riots that took place in Dublin after the war, on Armistice Day and then the victory parades in 1919, I think there are lumpen elements on both sides. People were always anti-authority. The fact that you're, British soldiers, my father was in the British Army in the Second World War, but, you'd think if talking to him that he'd been locked in mortal combat with a mysterious group called the Red Caps. The Germans would never be mentioned, hardly. there's that anti-authority.
The Red Caps were the military police, right?
Yeah. Soldiers tend to be anti-authority. I mean, they're subjected to very severe discipline. Unlike the Irish volunteers, people are treated with contempt in the armed forces. It may have improved a bit in more recent times. But in those days, a soldier was a soldier. He was a cog in a wheel, and if he tried to be anything else, he was dealt with very severely. But just on the conscription thing itself, I think it was very interesting what John was saying about the civil disobedience levels, because it had to be civil disobedience, because in 1916, the volunteers were disarmed. In Dublin, one thing they tried to organise was block defence. They're going to effectively barricade, which you could do in the tenements, obviously more easily, barricade blocks of buildings to prevent soldiers or police coming in to take people away for the army. But they had to do it that way because there was no question of using guns, because they didn't have any guns. And the same with the Women's Pledge. It was all a case of mobilising people for what would have been mass passive resistance, because it was the only option available. And I think, in fact, if you look back, the conscription campaign was the most successful, I would say it's the most unconditional victory the Irish people have ever won against the British state, and it was won without anyone dying.
Wouldn't you also agree that it's probably the most unified the country's ever been?
Yes.
Or at least nationalist Ireland.
Yeah.
With the exception of Northeast Ulster, of course.
With the exception of Northeast Ulster, yeah, exactly. That I mean, it could, because you had labor, labor was really, I would argue that labor was as important or more important than the Republicans were at this stage. Mm. The Republicans, constitutional nationalists, and the Catholic Church. I mean, the Catholic Church came out really heavy in favor of the anti-conscription campaign.
Now, I'll ask Porrick first, what effect did the war have on the unionist communities in Dublin and Cork?
Well, I wouldn't be qualified, and I'm sure John would be much better to answer the Cork end of it, but in Dublin, there was a very large community. I mean, there were 92,000-odd unionists and Protestants. Basically, they were the same. I know people talk about people like Countess Markovic and so on, but the overwhelming majority of Protestants in the South were unionist in their politics. And in Dublin city and county, there were over 90,000, which was the biggest concentration anywhere on this island outside of Belfast. So those people, overwhelmingly middle class, there was a small Protestant working class, but they didn't identify with as such. The areas where they were strong were the higher professions, white collar workers, the aristocracy, obviously, the higher echelons in society. They were very much under siege during the war. Remember, they had a terrible bloodletting of the sons of that generation. Some of them, like the Earl of Donoughmore, who was the Grand Master of the Freemasons in Ireland, spent almost the entire war out of the country. He was here, funnily enough, during the Easter Rising. And Lord Dunsany, another prominent figure, was actually taken prisoner by the rebels in the forecourts. Basically, they were cowed. It's very obvious when you read compensation claims, for example, to to the Grants Commission that was set up in London about small businessmen losing their enterprises, basically, because they had contracts with the government or with the army. They lost those. No one else would touch them. Landladies who ran boarding houses for British Army officers were shunned, were boycotted, had to get out of the country because they had no income coming in. There was a very limited amount of violence. There was very little physical violence. There was nothing to compare with the Belfast pogroms. But there was that freezing out of people and making it impossible for them to earn a living in this country. Who left or who felt alienated enough, like Sir Henry Robinson, the vice president of the local government board, whose house was actually besieged during the Civil War. He had a gun battle himself and the son, who was a former British Army officer. They surrendered in the end because the IRA threatened to burn the house over their heads and they wanted to protect the family inside. And Robinson said, in fairness, to give the devil his due, as he put it, they honoured the terms of the surrender. But you had that sort of situation. But most people, it was just a very cold climate in which to try and survive. And people felt that. Politically, most people who voted unionist in 1914 would have been voting for the Municipal Reform Association by 1920. They would have been gravitating towards these other groups that became associated to some extent with Fine Gael in the Free State, but they were losing their unionist identity as such. Mm. They were fighting the ratepayers' cause or the taxpayers' cause or the property classes. And it was interesting what John was saying about a run on the banks, that the poor, of course, couldn't have a run on the banks because they had no money in them. But certainly the Protestants' community was feeling the cold by 1920-21.
Mm-hmm. You know, without getting into the very fraught debate over the War of Independence in Cork City, how did the Great War treat the unionist community there?
Well, you know, what's interesting, at the outbreak of the war, you see the kind of missed opportunity the British government, Dublin Castle, had, because you see the Cork City unionists trying to join, and in some cases join in the National Volunteers. So you see a lot of kind of the gentry offering, you know, ex-British officers, gentry, doing double-barreled names, coming in as senior organizers in the National Volunteers. The Church of Ireland Young Men's Association was trying to set up a National Volunteer branch to join. The Suffragettes, who were Munster, were moderate and predominantly unionist. They formed an ambulance corps. So the unionist population, the Protestant population here in Cork, was mobilizing on behalf of the war and were reaching out to the National Volunteers. So had the National Volunteers been given that kind of identity and kind of given the scope to set up a Redmond kind of Irish Party nationalist division unit, you would have seen, it would have been kind of inclusive to unionists, and you would have seen a lot of unionists joining. They were trying to join in the end of 1914, so that was an interesting thing. But as you know, the same thing happened in Cork, it happened in Dublin, as Potter said. By the end of it, you know, the Unionist Party in the city was pretty much destroyed. A lot of people were, there were some militants, hardliners, still kind of holding out against home rule, but the kind of the big migration was towards kind of a Dominion home rule, a limited home rule, and a lot of people also became out, and the unionists here joined the Irish Dominion League, trying to get Dominion status for Ireland in 1919, 1920, 21 especially, and then a lot of them, you know, endorsed the Free State. So the unionist population here was pretty much accepted, and by 1919, 1920 realized that the only thing that was going to happen, the best case probably scenario, was a reasonable home rule where they were included and had their civil liberties protected. And then same thing, as Padraig said, same thing happened in Cork, where they started supporting civil kind of economic commercial candidates. There's like a commercial party, basically a small business party, and the Protestants start supporting that. So it's kind of similar dynamics in two different, very different places.
What are your thoughts on how we should remember the Great War in Ireland today, Pork?
I don't know, to be honest. It's very fraught. It's going to be difficult. I think we have to realize it was a very big event. It was a universal suffering, basically, brought about by the collapse of a ruling elite in 1914 in all the big powers, who were faced with a huge crisis, and they didn't know, they hadn't got the competence or the wherewithal to solve that problem. Very similar to the situation today. Hopefully we don't go down the same route. But it was a crisis in the ruling class, which they couldn't resolve, and everybody else had to foot the bill for it. And I think we should regard people who died, personally I regard people who died, as primarily victims of the power system that had been created then, and paid a terrible price for what had happened. I don't think we should get into a hierarchy of victimhood one way or the other, who suffered more than anybody else. We all know where that leads. That's one thing to be avoided. I think we have to concentrate, certainly historians have to concentrate, on establishing the facts. And doing that as honestly and as accurately as they can, and with whole judgment as far as possible, until you have something to judge.
Yeah, and I agree. I'm not very comfortable with celebrations of mass casualties and mass fatalities. I think everybody should be allowed to mourn and remember according to how they deem fit, but they should also make sure that everybody's given enough space to mark the occasion in the way they want to do it. And if that means they don't want to mark it at all, that's more power to them, or that's their decision. Everybody has their own individual decision about how to remember this. I'm all for commemorating and remembering and trying to understand. To me as a historian, that's the best thing we can get out of this, is an increased understanding of what happened. And I think there is a strong desire for that. And as a historian, that's what I'm trying to participate in. I'm not really interested in involved in commemoration projects or celebrations especially. But if I can help people understand what happened, I'd consider the decade very well spent.
Well, thank you very much, John Borgonovo and Pádraig Yates. If you'd like to listen to this or previous episodes of the show, you can go to the Near FM podcast page on nearfm.ie/podcast, or you can email us on history@near.ie. My name is Cathal Brennan, and on behalf of myself, my co-presenter John Dorney, thank you very much.